dinosaurs were really, really big. But size isn't everything.
So in the time of dinosaurs, of course, people are astonished by the enormous bulk of some of these huge dinosaurs, the things like the sauropods with the long necks and long tails. I mean, these creatures are, hundreds of tons. We don't even know how large they could grow. They were enormous. And the predators, of course, things like T-Rex. People are really awed by those creatures. And they have a tendency to think that because they were larger, that somehow makes them better or more successful. But really, if we kind of flip things around a little bit and have a look at the opposite end of the scale, it's almost as if mammals at this time thought, right, okay, they're looking at the dinosaurs thinking, well, they've got big covered. What could we do to be different?
That's Elsa Panciaroli. We talk with her about her book, Beasts Before Us, The Untold Story of Mammal Origins and Evolution. Then, motivated by the pandemic lockdown, many people renewed a gardening tradition begun in World War II, the Victory Garden. They found you don't need a lot of space to grow your own food.
People doing victory gardens in World War II also often didn't have a traditional garden space, and so they just looked for any little bit of land they could grab onto and put a few seeds in. And that's what was happening in our country in 2020 and 2021. People were just kind of scrabbling around trying to find some way that they could grow a few vegetables anywhere they could, any way they could, even if they'd never done it before. They thought it was worth trying. So it was almost like that same generational sense of trying to do what you could to keep everybody safe, to make sure your family had some fresh, nice, fresh food. It just migrated from 1945 to 2020.
We kick off the gardening season talking with gardening book author Maggie Stuckey. Her latest is The Container Victory Garden, A Beginner's Guide to Growing Your Own Groceries. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Mammals like us got our start when the dinosaurs went extinct 66 million years ago, right? No, actually. We began way before that, when the Earth had only one giant continent and centipedes the size of cars roamed the land. It was like an alien planet. Why is this important? Because, as we are now in the midst of the sixth mass extinction event in the Earth's history, thanks to us, we can learn a whole lot about life, extinction, and regeneration from the long, long mammal lineage we come from. Elsa Panciaroli's book, Beasts Before Us, provides a fascinating and uplifting look at the resilience of life on this planet through the lens of how mammals came to be. It reframes the narrative of our mammalian ancestors and provides a counterpoint to the stereotypes of mighty dinosaur overlords and cowering little mammals. It turns out the earliest mammals weren't just precursors. They were pioneers. Elsa Panciaroli is a Scottish paleontologist who studies the evolution and ecology of extinct animals. Elsa Panciaroli, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
First, would you just briefly tell us a little bit about your work? You're at the Oxford University Museum of Natural History and at the National Museums of Scotland. So just tell us a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, I'm really interested in where mammals come from, particularly their anatomy and their physiology. So, for example, there are a host of things that make mammals the creatures that we know them today, like they produce milk and they're warm-blooded and they have fur. And I'm really interested in finding out where some of these really fundamental things come from. And a lot of those traits can be traced back to the Mesozoic, which is the time of dinosaurs. So I work on fossils from the Jurassic in particular and try to uncover the sort of path of their evolution.
The subtitle to this book is The Untold Story of Mammal Evolution. why is the story so untold?
This is a really good question, and it was very important to me in writing the book to get that in there. So there are quite a few books about the origin of mammals, but you'll find if you browse through them that almost every one of them starts about 66 million years ago when the dinosaurs or the non-bird dinosaurs become extinct. So that sounds like an awful long time ago, but for people who work in geological time, that's relatively recently. And really, it's almost like starting, if evolution was the film Jurassic Park, it would be like starting when the helicopter takes off at the end and they're all safe. You know, this is really the end of the movie. Mammals are mammals. They're kind of, okay, they do amazing things and I love them. And I could write another book all about them in the last 66 million years. But their real origins and the history of how they became the creatures they are, it starts long, long before that. And if you search for that story, that sort of prequel, as it were, you'll find that there are almost no books that really talk about it for the general public. You'll only find a few specialist academic sort of books. So I was really keen, as I myself found out this story as a researcher, I couldn't wait to tell people about it. And eventually that sort of turned into this book.
Before we get into actually talking about mammals, this book also has some very interesting things to say about the science of studying extinct mammals. You say in this book that we're now seeing a radical transformation in the science of extinct life. What is that transformation about?
I think there are several different ways to answer that question. I mean, one of them is a technological change. You know, we, of course, through time are creating more and more new ways to sort of interrogate the fossil record, new methods. For example, one of the ones I use quite often is something called synchrotron scanning. So if you think of the kind of CT scan you might get in a hospital, a synchrotron scan basically allows you to do the same kind of thing with X-rays, but you can do it to a submicron level. So you can see bacteria, essentially, things that are absolutely and utterly microscopic. And this lets us look at the histology, that is the actual formation of the bones and of the structures of the body in animals that were extinct, have been extinct for millions of years. So it unlocks a whole bunch of new questions, things that we just couldn't answer previously just by looking at the bones. So there are several different types of technologies that are doing things like that. They're basically letting us, in fact, look at fossils that have previously been studied, but ask a whole new host of questions.
For example.
But I guess, yeah, the other thing is coming back to what you said there about the sort of more, the more about the attitude towards paleontology is that, paleontology is obviously part of a broader geological sciences and earth sciences. And those historically have been very extractive processes, extractive sciences and part of big extractive industries. And that's still partly true, but people are beginning to sort of take a second look and think about the ethics of what we're doing when we're taking fossils from countries around the world. And also who it is that's carrying out these studies. Is it the people in the countries these fossils come from, or is it people from other countries going in there and kind of taking them away, as has sort of really been the case for quite a long time in our history? So there really is a revolution in how we're thinking about what we do and how we approach it. And we're trying to make it a better science, a more ethical science.
One great example of that is when it comes to the human mammal, where you talk about digs that are being done with the indigenous communities where the bones are being discovered. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. I think that was in South Africa, is that correct?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be involved in ongoing work in South Africa, in this really wonderful little village. I'm not going to pronounce the name correctly, which is I really feel really embarrassed. But it's my attempt to pronounce it is Kamega, and it's about 8 hours drive south of Johannesburg. And it is an absolutely wonderful little village. The people there basically made the first discoveries in their area of dinosaurs. They knew exactly what they were. And they contacted people at the University of Witwatersrand and began working together with them to find new bones, to extract the ones that are there and to work on them afterwards. So it's a really great example of an instance where the researchers who were called in by the community made sure that they continue to involve the community in the work. And not just that, but also find other ways to help supply the community with, for example, learning materials for their schools and other things that they might want to make sure that it's a two-way process. So that work is ongoing. It's a really good example, but it doesn't happen often enough, I think. We still need to kind of catch ourselves and make sure that we are doing our best to ask the people who find these sorts of discoveries, what do they actually want from the process and how do they want to be involved?
You also take on a very ingrained idea, and that is the notion of progress from lower or more so-called primitive life forms to more advanced. What is wrong with this idea?
Yeah, this idea is something that some people will say, oh, we don't think like that anymore. But it's so deeply ingrained in the way that we talk about evolution in general and the way we talk about fossils, that even when you are trying to avoid using that kind of terminology, it creeps back in because we tend to think. So it basically stems from originally when the first natural historians, the first scientists were trying to describe the process of evolution as they looked at the fossil record. They described it as really coming from the sort of the bacteria, the simple organisms, and getting not just more and more complex, but what they saw as more and more advanced. So they were inherently judging that an animal with a backbone is better than an animal without one, and that an animal that then walked on two legs was better than one that walked on four. Mammals were better than reptiles, and they had this scale that they basically placed everything on. And obviously, humans were at the very top, particularly white male humans were at the very, very top of the scale. And so they ranked everything. And of course, not only is this, we kind of realize with you know, reassessing this, it's obviously not correct for many, many reasons, but it also leads you to misinterpret nature and to start to place judgments on things that you observe when you're observing how the evolutionary processes work. So we start to, one thing I encounter a lot, for example, is I work in a lot of very small mammals from the time of dinosaurs that are about the size of rats and mice. And people are always saying to me, well, how come they were so kind of rubbish and they didn't do very well and dinosaurs were so great and so successful? And that's a little example of that kind of language creeping in. Just because something's small doesn't actually mean it's not as good or that it's somehow failing in evolution. And just because the dinosaurs were large, it doesn't mean they were winning. The idea of winning and losing is not really the way to look at it, because in every moment, any animal alive is the best thing in that moment. You know, it's best adapted for whatever it's doing. The real crux is that things change, and they change constantly throughout time. And that's why, of course, extinction happens.
Wow, there's so much in there, so much rich food for thought. One thing I think of is that if you think that there is inevitable progress and you think that things are more advanced than other things, then that gives you the right to dominate them. And, you know, you do point out that there's a pretty shameful record of, you know, these white males of the 19th and 20th century, well, especially in the 19th century, of viewing other peoples as specimens and wreaking some violence on them, not just the violence of colonialism, but colonialism as paleontology as colonialism.
Absolutely. If you start to see things on a scale and you start to feel that one group is somehow superior to others, it can be used as a justification for all kinds of actions. And certainly, particularly in the late 1800s and early 1900s, this took place quite a lot within paleontology and particularly within the study of human origins. And non-white people were seen, as you say, as specimens. And I hate to use the word, they were collected and their remains taken from places that they should not have been, and without any permission and without any dignity, sent around the world for collections. And thankfully, this is not happening anymore. But we, of course, have museums that are filled with such material. And it's now our job to think about what we do with that material and to speak to communities and work out how to, I don't want to say fix it, because you can't fix something that is so fundamentally, it has been done wrong, but to make amends and to find a new way forward. And thankfully, yeah, as I say, thankfully that kind of thing is not happening anymore.
And there's something very interesting to me that you said, that there's no such thing as a living fossil. And this is something I've often, it's a term I've used. I live in a beach community in New York where there are horseshoe crabs. And, you know, people refer to the horseshoe crabs as living fossils because they're, you know, supposedly go back 350 million years or something like that, back to even the first era that you speak about in this book, Elsa Panciarolli, this book Beasts Before Us. So what do you mean by there's no such thing as a living fossil or a missing link?
Those are both terms that are still very commonly used. And they do kind of have some sense. They have a meaning, but they are kind of misleading. So let's go for the living fossil first. So the idea of a living fossil is, of course, that a creature like a horseshoe crab has not changed for a very, very long time outwardly. And so we kind of sort of say, you know, well, the fossil looks identical to the living thing. But I guess it's misleading for a number of reasons. One is that although at first glance they might appear similar, there's absolutely no way that any species is static. And those fossil creatures that look very like living horseshoe crabs, they're related, but they aren't the same animal. The animals have changed. And people who, of course, experts in whichever group you're talking about, will be able to list many, many different features that have changed. It's just that they haven't changed so much that it's obvious. So I guess one thing it does is it gives people this idea that evolution is static at any point, which is not true. Everything is constantly changing. How much it changes and whether it's changing outwardly or perhaps more in terms of its genetics, that's what varies. So something like a horseshoe crab, if you were able to sample the DNA of these ancient fossils that look the same, you'd probably find that they were radically different. They've changed a lot. It's just that we can't observe it. So people tend to not like to use living fossil for that reason. It makes things seem misleading, but it also can affect people's sort of judgment. We were talking previously about whether something had, you know, was given a value judgment. And a really good example is the platypus in Australia. So there's a great book out at the moment by Jack Ashby about Australian mammals and how our language about them makes us less likely to conserve them and less likely to regard them as the incredibly advanced as any other animal. God, I've gone and done it there. I've gone and said advanced. As evolved as any other animal, it leads us to think that they are not. So the platypus is often called a living fossil. So people get this idea that it's kind of had its day, that it's not changed. So therefore, it's obviously backward and it's not doing as good a job at being an animal as other animals are. So it leads to all these other sort of implicit ideas about creatures when we use that kind of language. So that's why most researchers don't tend to say something is a living fossil. They just, all those connotations kind of detract from really having a good idea of what evolution means. A missing link it's a similar story. Missing link gives us the idea that each creature we find is part of some kind of ladder, that you're going to find, you know, the ancestor and then its offspring and then its offspring and its offspring. But the truth of the fossil record is that we don't, all of these animals, they can be related to one another, but none are the direct, you know, great-great-grandparent or great-great-grandson of the other. They're placed within a tree, but the common ancestors that unite them, we don't actually know what they are. So it just gives a slightly incorrect idea of how, again, how evolution works. Evolution is branching. Evolution is like a tree, as opposed to a missing link, which gives you an idea that it's more of a chain. It's a straight line.
Yeah, you call human beings a side branch of the apes.
We are. we're really just one tiny, tiny little minuscule branch. It's just that we happen to have ended up becoming such an overwhelming presence on our planet.
Indeed. And we are speaking with Elsa Pancharoli about her book, Beast Before Us, The Untold Story of Mammal Origins and Evolution. Now, we mentioned the horseshoe crabs going back 350 million years. You go way back to then when the land on Earth was all part of one big continent. Describe that world for us. The mammals were there even then, quite different from ones today. Describe the world and describe those mammals.
Yeah, so if we want to really trace the beginning of the mammal story, we have to go back to over 300 million years ago. So the time period is called the Carboniferous. And carbon, as in the carbon that forms the oil and gas that we has fueled our industrial revolution. So the planet at this time, all the continents are coming together, and they're going to be soon in the following time period form this supercontinent called Pangaea. So the world is really, it's almost in two halves. Half of it is land and half of it is this vast unbroken sea. And on the land, things would have looked really quite different. Most of the continent was covered in forest, swampy, wet forest. But the trees were not trees as we know them. They were actually ancient relatives of things like quillworts and little lycopsids. These are very, very small understory plants today. But back then they were tree size. They were 30 meters or more. So in these hot, swampy forests, we had the very first backboned animals that had come onto land. And of course, they were following the first insects that had crawled out quite a bit before that time. And those insects there was a lot that we would recognize. The first ancestors of arachnids, you know, spiders and those kinds of animals. And also the first ancestors of dragonflies or close relatives of dragonflies. And also the first millipedes and centipedes. But, and here's the kind of the really crazy thing, there was a lot more oxygen in the atmosphere at that time. And the increased level of oxygen and the warmth of the planet meant that these insects were enormous. So we have things like millipedes that are as big as motorbikes, and you've got these dragonfly relatives that are more like the size of seagulls. So this is a planet that is really almost alien to us, but our very, very earliest relatives this is when they have their beginning, right back at this time period.
So this Carboniferous age ended in the Permian age, or was it the same thing as the Permian?
So the Permian comes after this. So in the Carboniferous, as I say, we have these first backboned four-limbed animals on land. And they've already split into the lineage that's going to end up leading to salamanders and frogs and, you know, other amphibians. And then and they're the ones that lay eggs that don't have a shell, as you know, like frog spawn. But then we have the lineage that we belong to, and these are what we call amniotes. So those are animals that lay eggs with shells. Now, of course, mammals don't do that anymore, but we come from these ancestors that do, and we share a common ancestor with reptiles, because of course they still do lay eggs as well. So those are the creatures that we originally evolved from. They would have looked, if you were looking back in time, you'd probably think, you know, oh look, there's a really big lizard or something like that. But actually, they are not lizards or mammals. They're this kind of thing that came before. They're just tetrapods. And they're the ones that are going to eventually give rise both to mammals and to reptiles.
Four-footed creatures, yeah. So the Permian extinction, that was the worst so far, and it did wipe out so many of these mammals, or the precursors of mammals. And the dinosaurs took over from the mammals then. Why is that? What made the dinosaurs able to survive or rebound or develop in a way that mammals couldn't after the Permian extinction?
Well, first, I think it's worth spending a bit of time talking about the Permian, because I think this is another thing that adds to the kind of amazing story of where mammals come from. Their ancestors, as I say, splits from the ancestors of reptiles in the Carboniferous. And then in the Permian, it's actually the ancestors of mammals, they're called synapsids, that kind of take off first, and they become large and they evolve into this incredible diversity of creatures. Some of them you might be familiar with. Most of them, I think most people are not familiar with. So one of the familiar ones is Dimetrodon, which is that creature that you'll have seen. It looks like a big reptile with a huge sail on its back, and it's very often accidentally kind of put in the same category as dinosaurs. But it's actually one of our ancient relatives. It's one of these synapsids. And creatures like that kind of took over the world, as it were. They became mega herbivores, mega carnivores. Some of them were climbing trees. They were digging. They were basically sort of forming these first recognizable ecosystems that, you know, that we would recognize today. But all of that diversity at the end of the Permian is lost in this incredible mass extinction at the end of the Permian, the greatest mass extinction of all time, where around about 85% of life on Earth was wiped out. And this happened because of massive volcanic eruptions that took place in what's now Siberia. And it altered the atmosphere and destroyed basically all the ecosystems that had formed up to that point. And then following that, we go from that sort of age of synapsids. That's when the age of the so-called age of dinosaurs, or really the age of reptiles, began. And why one would do better than the other in one time period or the other, it's really down to luck. The fact that the synapsids did so well before in the Permian, there's not really a clear reason why they did so well to begin with. And again, after the mass extinction at the end of the Permian, it's not clear why the reptiles were the ones that kind of took off and became dinosaurs and pterosaurs and marine reptiles. We actually kind of can't answer that question. And it really looks like it's probably more of a luck of the draw. What happened to survive, where it survived, what the resources were like. And it's a bit of a sort of race, isn't it? Which one gets big first? That's the one that takes that ecological space. And it usually prevents other animals from evolving into that ecological space. So in the Mesozoic, that's the time after this mass extinction, it was the reptiles that did that. And the mammals had to do something a little bit different.
Yes.
Well, I love talking about this because it really gets to what we were talking about you know, success and so-called losers in evolution. So in the time of dinosaurs, of course, people are astonished by the enormous bulk of some of these huge dinosaurs, the things like the sauropods with the long necks and long tails. I mean, these creatures are, you know, hundreds of tons. We don't even know how large they could grow. They were enormous. And the predators, of course, things like T-Rex. People are really awed by those creatures. And they have a tendency to think that because they were larger, that somehow makes them better or more successful. But really, if we kind of flip things around a little bit and have a look at the opposite end of the scale, it's almost as if mammals at this time thought, right, okay, they're looking at the dinosaurs thinking, well, they've got big covered. What could we do to be different? And obviously evolution doesn't work like that, but I'd love to think it does, because they basically, that's exactly what they do. They become very, very small. By the end of the Triassic, all the mammals that we know of from that time period, they're not quite true mammals yet. They're known as mammalia forms. That's sort of just outside mammals. They are incredibly small, the size of shrews. I mean, they would easily curl up and go to sleep in the palm of your hand. But this has a radical effect on their entire bodies. They're small, and they are also probably nocturnal at this time. And they also have warm blood, which is new and unusual. And they have fur. We know that by this point they've developed whiskers and fur. And so if they're also nocturnal, insect eating, their senses become really highly tuned because they have to, of course, navigate this dark world. And a lot of them are diggers, so they're also underground navigating these tunnels. So their brains grow larger to compensate for all of the sensory information, the acute hearing and the excellent sense of smell that they're developing. And essentially, this makes mammals what they are today. Large-brained, warm-blooded, furry little creatures that feed their young on milk. It all happens at the same time as the dinosaurs, but they just happen to be little. But it's still a revolution in terms of evolution. And it has, of course, later, when the roles reversed again, led to this great mammal success in the last 66 million years.
One of the most important things I learned about in this book, Beasts Before Us, was, we've talked about some of it already, and that is thinking about extinctions, because it's something much on my mind, like it is on many people today. We are in the midst of the sixth extinction that we are causing. This book is really about how species extinctions happen and how species rebound, or how life rebounds after extinctions. What are your thoughts on what is the same and what's different about the human-caused extinction that's happening now? Could life rebound, or could it not actually rebound? How would it rebound? And on what time scale are we talking about?
These are questions that a lot of paleontologists are grappling with, and of course, conservationists. And there's actually a whole new discipline of conservation paleobiology, where we're trying to combine those two skill sets, looking at the deep past and looking at the present day, and trying to use the past to help us learn and figure out what to do. So I guess to answer your question about whether life will rebound, one of the consolations I find in the fossil record is that life does always rebound. Really, until I don't know, is it 4 billion years time, when the sun expands to the point where the Earth burns up, life is probably always going to rebound. It's very difficult to wipe life out. But what kind of life are we talking about? How rich and diverse do we want to see the world being? Do I think life will always survive? Definitely. But I personally would like to see a really diverse world. I don't want to see all of the incredible things that have evolved over the last 500 million years. I don't want to see most of them being destroyed. So there's a message of hope, but also one of caution. When we look at the biggest mass extinction of all time at the end of the Permian, but really when we look at all of them, the primary cause is usually changes in our atmosphere, changes in the balance of carbon dioxide and oxygen. So we know how dangerous that can be, and we know that it can have a massive effect that can reach from the very bottom to the very top of an ecosystem. How quickly ecosystems recover after mass extinctions depends on how big those extinctions are. So there's lots and lots of extinctions through time. The small ones can be recovered from relatively quickly. We're talking maybe hundreds, thousands, or a couple of million years, which geologically speaking is quite quick. But the Permian, for example, it took at least 20 million years before we start to see the same kind of complexity in ecosystems as we saw before the mass extinction. So, you know, we obviously would like to avoid that. I very much doubt we would be around in that kind of timescale. So I guess what I'm saying is that we should be trying to make this, the extinction's already happening right now, and we should be trying to make it as small as possible, because then life will be able to recover more quickly.
Hear, hear. Thank you so much, Elsa Panciaroli. I mean, this is a wonderful book, Beasts Before Us, The Untold Story of Mammal Evolution. It's about so much more than just mammal evolution. In many ways, it's in the portal to thinking about our own times.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You can read an excerpt from Beasts Before Us at writersvoice.net. Next up, how to garden in containers. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Well, gardening season is heating up. My seedlings are sitting in the greenhouse, waiting for warmer days to get into the ground or get into the container. I've relied on containers for some of my homegrown veggies for a number of reasons, like convenient access and protection from voles and slugs. But many folks rely on them for lack of space. But gardening in containers can be tricky. They can get too little or too much water, and you have to get varieties that thrive in small spaces. Maggie Stuckey's new book, The Container Victory Garden, is a great guide for beginners. It also recounts the history of victory gardens from their start in World War I to their flourishing in World War II, with stories about some of those gardeners of old peppering the pages of her book. Maggie Stuckey is the author of numerous books about gardening, including Gardening from the Ground Up and The Complete Herb Book. Maggie Stuckey, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Why did you decide to write a book about doing victory gardens? Why now?
Well, I write gardening books, you know, so that's my always my focus. I'm just sort of thinking about what's happening in the gardening world. But I noticed, and if anybody listening who does any gardening will remember what happened in 2020, suddenly you couldn't find seeds anywhere. It never happened in living memory of anybody. Everybody was out of seeds. And I was thinking, what is this all about? And it became clear to me that what it was about was we were encouraged not to make trips outside in the general public unless there's absolutely no choice, which means one of the things you can't do comfortably or you can't do without being scared is go to the grocery store. So it seemed to me, thinking back on it, that maybe everybody at the exact same moment had the same idea. Well, we'll just start a little garden. At least we'll have fresh vegetables for the table, including a lot of people who'd never done it before, and including people who really didn't have a garden space. And that becomes important in a minute. But the mindset was a lot like World War II, when people doing victory gardens in World War II also often didn't have a traditional garden space. And so they just looked for any little bit of land they could grab onto and put a few seeds in. And that's what was happening in our country in 2020 and 2021. People were just kind of scrabbling around trying to find some way that they could grow a few vegetables anywhere they could, any way they could, even if they'd never done it before. They thought it was worth trying. So it was almost like that same generational sense of trying to do what you could to keep everybody safe, to make sure your family had some fresh, nice, fresh food. It just migrated from 1945 to 2020. Intact, the same way of looking at the world. So then I thought, this is World War II victory gardens all over again. And that's what prompted me to go back and learn what I could about it.
And a huge amount of food was grown in those victory gardens of World War II. How much?
Yes. Yeah. I'm not sure I can come up with a number off the top of my head, but it was millions and millions.
Let's drill down to the individual. You tell some stories, and one of them is the story of Marion Lee and her uncle's potatoes. So tell us that story.
Marion Lee is probably the sweetest woman I have ever known in my entire life. And I'm probably going to start crying because I have to tell you that she died a few months ago at the age of 100. She lived most of her young life with her aunt and uncle, and her uncle worked for a railroad, a passenger railroad. He was injured on the job, and so he had to be, whatever the term they use, forcible retirement. But he didn't want to retire. So on his own time, he would just sort of walk along the tracks. He was a maintenance guy, and he knew how to spot trouble that was about to happen. So he would just kind of wander along and take a look at things and make sure his colleagues weren't going to be in trouble in a few days. And Marion and her cousins, this man's children, often went along with him as if it was after school hours. And he used to always have in his pocket seed potatoes. And as they walked along the rail bed, he would kind of, you know how you dig your heel into the ground, you can kind of scuff up a little hole. He would do that and drop a seed potato in, and then with his foot, push the dirt back over on top of it and pat it down, and they would just keep going. Somebody finally said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, just plant potatoes. Somebody might need them." He said, "Planting potatoes, we'll come back later and get them." And then, but when they came back later, they discovered in almost all cases, somebody had beaten them to it.
That's such a great story.
But Marion had to be an adult before she figured out that that was exactly what he intended all along, because that was the Depression. And there's so many young men kind of riding the rails and with no standard place to get something to eat.
So now let's talk about, I mean, this is also a really, really a how-to book. And I know I'm very interested in container gardening. I mean, I have a garden, but I also have a container garden because my regular garden is beset with slugs and voles and all kinds of critters. And I always lose some, and I can protect them better if they're in containers, but it's not that easy to grow in containers. There are things that you also have to watch for. So that's why this book is so useful. You say you should, if you just want to start out as the first thing, you start out with a big container and separate it into three concentric circles. Why?
Well, I wrote this book for beginners. Remember, we're talking 2020 now, and I'm thinking this through, and so many people are growing vegetables for the first time. And I always worry that we garden writers do a disservice to beginners. We sort of assume, because something is so dang clear in our minds, that they know it too. So thinking of it in concentric circles is one way to just have a picture in your mind of what you're about to do. So I just found it a helpful device for beginners. It lets them visualize what's going to happen and be ready for what's going to happen, so they're not hit by some kind of surprise that they don't know what to do with.
But what would you put in those concentric circles, for example?
Well, in the middle, if you're starting this in the spring, which often happens because that's when all the plants are on sale and you can't help it, you'd go and buy them, you know. The very middle would be empty. Temporarily. And around the middle circle would be things that can survive the tag in of the coolish spring weather, but are really going to flourish when the weather gets warm, like herbs, like beans and peas, especially beans. I call them string beans, even though, you know, they haven't had strings for a long, long time. And you have to plant those as seeds because that's the only way they come. So a pile of bean seeds are in the middle circle. And the outer circle could be, because that's realistically the one that's going to be easiest to get to, should be things that have been flourishing as a cool season plant that are going to need your attention, because pretty soon you're going to have to do something with them. They're going to reach the end of their natural life, and you will have to take them out and replace them with something else. And that's a good place for color, like pansies and violas, which are edible. Not everybody knows that, but they're so beautiful, and they do really well in quite cool temperatures. It doesn't seem to bother them. And it gives everybody a little boost to walk out and see those pretty cute little faces that go with those pansies, you know. Things like scallions grow well, and even bush peas like snow peas and edible pod peas, as well as regular English peas. Those are all cool season plants. So you can, and many of our salad greens like the lettuces and the kale, those also really belong in the cool season ring. So because they're because they're the closest to the edge, it's easier to look at them really carefully and see if they're still okay for another couple of weeks, or if you need to start thinking about it's time for them to come out so that a warm season thing can go in that space. It's a little bit like choreography, you know? You think about a dance troupe on the stage. Sometimes the dancers in the back move forward, move downstage closer to the front, and the people from the front either move to the back or move off stage entirely. So you're just constantly planning ahead for what you're going to need to do next week so that there's always something growing. But that's the real issue for container gardeners. You have to start with understanding that if you have a container garden, you have limited space. I mean, that's a given. And if your goal is to actually grow food for your family's dinner table, you want to have always something that's ready to harvest. You always want to have something that's getting ready to go in that space next, so that there's always something growing. There's never an empty spot.
Why did you decide to write a book about doing victory gardens? And of course, then you have a lot of great suggestions for varieties of vegetables to grow that are good to grow in containers. And I think this is where I wasn't aware of things like thumbelina carrots until I read your book. I ended up getting carrots last year from a container garden, a pot that I grew them in, but they were tiny anyway because they really didn't have enough room to grow. So talk a little bit about varieties and how to choose them.
Well, I'll tell you a personal story. I first started being interested in container vegetable garden 20 years ago. I moved from a house with a backyard garden into an apartment, which has no garden space. I have a patio about the size of a bandana, and that's it. So I thought, well, I really want to grow vegetables because that's where my heart is, because I love to cook also. So I guess I'll just have to do it in containers. I went to the library, which is where I go when I need to learn something new, to check out a book on how you grow a vegetable garden in containers, and there weren't any. Nobody had ever written about this. And I thought, well, dang, I can't possibly be the only person in the world who'd like to know about this. So I decided that would be my next book. And I did a couple of years of experiments, just trying out to see what would work and what wouldn't work. And most of all, what was not worth the trouble. Your carrot story fits right in there because those big, long carrots take a long time to grow. And that's a foolish waste. It's not a waste, but it's a foolish use of what's very limited space to begin with.
And they're so cheap to buy in the supermarket, too.
Yeah, exactly. All year long, you know. But at that point, the whole idea of having vegetables in containers was not a very common idea. In fact, most people thought I was kind of crazy. But over time, it's become clear that, in fact, it's not a crazy idea. And the horticulture industry quickly cottoned on to the fact that so many people who would like to grow their own vegetables, who are interested in healthy organic foods and all that stuff, live in apartments these days. And what are they going to do? So they quickly began breeding varieties of our favorite vegetables. These are not all, you know, far out there weird stuff. This is regular, ordinary vegetables, but there is container versions of them. Meaning, like for carrots, they don't take 6 months to get full grown, or they have a compact, tight growth habit so they don't kind of sprawl all over the place. You can put 3 or 4 or 10 different things in one container because each one of them stays kind of small. There, I found some varieties where the people who write the copy for the seed catalogs would call them polite or tidy or well-behaved, meaning that they produce what we want, but the plant itself is small and easy to work with. And that has happened just in the last 10 years. And every year there's several dozen new varieties. It's hard to keep track, but it's so much fun to explore.
So I have a couple of questions. You know, I use row covers on my outdoor garden, you know, or my garden that's not in containers, it's in the ground. How do you use row covers with containers? Because I find I really do need them to keep some of the pests off.
Right. Yeah, you certainly could. You could take the actual commercial product that you buy and sort of cut it down. Or people can create their own, any kind of upright support, even large chopsticks, you know, or a branches from the shrubbery in your neighbor's yard the next time they go pruning, and then just spread this row cover. I've never personally done it, but I've heard of people just actually use an old sheet that's, you know, ready for recycling anyway. But the row covers like Remay is a brand I'm personally familiar with. And then you kind of tuck it down underneath the bottom so the winds don't blow it away. Really good for keeping out things that would fly in, you know, like those
aphids.
Yeah. But here's the cool thing about container gardening. I'm talking now about the vast majority of people who do it because they have no other choice. So their containers are on their patio or on their balcony or on their deck or on the front porch, somewhere close to the door that they go in and out of all the time. And that means, among other things, that they can't help but stop to just take a look at it, say hello, pat them, you know, if it herbs, run your fingers and get a nice smell of it. Which also means while you're doing that, you're looking at what's going on. And it's therefore easy to spot trouble quickly. Also, with a container, you have just a small space, which means the good side of that is you don't have 40 acres of cutworms. You just have maybe one plant that you have to pay attention to. So even if some of those little guys do sneak in when you're not looking, you can see them quickly because you're spending time looking at the plants anyway, and there's not many of them. So even if you get a serious problem, something that would be a huge problem if you had, you know, rows and rows and rows, you don't. You just got a few plants, and it's therefore easier to maintain.
One thing I was curious about is you counsel not using seeds past their deadline. However, seed prices are pretty high, and I've had success with using seeds from last year, as long as I store them correctly in a cool, dry place, and then I test my seeds.
I don't present that as a hard and fast rule. You're absolutely right. Many of them are totally fine the next year. And of course, the prices, like everything else in the world, right, have just gone crazy in the last couple of years. I do suggest that if they end up with some gardening buddies, which people usually do, because that's who you find your way to, somebody who knows the answers to your questions, go in together and buy several packets, knowing that you're going to divide them up. Because especially if you're in containers, you don't need 100 carrot seeds. You don't need, you know, 50 tomato seeds. You just need two or three. I think I made that comment because I was still thinking about my main audience being beginners. I wanted them to walk the road that's most likely to give them success and not walk the road that might possibly have the potential to create a problem for them.
And so finally, let's go out on the sunshine rule of thumb. This I did not know before I read this book, The Container Victory Garden, Maggie Stecky. What is the sunshine rule of thumb? Most useful.
Okay. If the plant makes the thing that you want to eat, if it first makes a flower before it makes that thing, then the plant really wants 6 hours of sun a day. It's almost all of our regular vegetables, all the legumes as well. They start with the flower and all the nightshades and all the squashes, everything. Well, pretty much everything. So here again, here's another way that container gardens will come to the aid of gardeners, because unless you're gardening in this gigantic thing that you found at somebody's barn, you have a pot that you can pick up So you pick, you know, as the sun goes through, makes its path through the sky, it takes a different arc as the year goes along. So if you stand on any one spot on your, let's say, on your deck, it's going to have a different sun pattern in April than it might have in September. Well, you pick the pot up and move it, which is really very simple. But when you think about it, it's magical. You can pick your garden up and move it around to follow the sun.
But there are vegetables that you can grow in partial shade, and those are the salad greens, which are right. They're wonderful. Yeah. In fact, I often find that I have to move them into the shade.
Exactly, yeah. Everything that we eat the leaf of, which is all the lettuces, all the salad greens, all the kale, the mustard greens, and all the wonderful Asian greens. I was just in my local Safeway the other day. I've gotten to know the produce manager pretty well, and I said, how come you don't have baby bok choy? I live by myself, and if I buy a whole head of bok choy, I can't eat it all before it goes bad. And I said, how come you don't have baby bok choy? And he cannot get it from any of his suppliers. That's fine with me because I grow my own. So all of those wonderful Asian greens are no more difficult to grow than just plain lettuce. And they're so wonderful and so inspiring for kind of unusual kinds of cooking adventures. You know, I just think they're wonderful. And in most cases, unless I live in a neighborhood with a large Southeast Asian population, so we have great grocers nearby. But if you're not that lucky, and you decide you want to buy things like baby bok choy, you're going to pay a pretty penny for it at these specialty greengrocer shops, you know?
Well, it's a wonderful book with great illustrations, The Container Victory Garden, A Beginner's Guide to Growing Your Own Groceries. Maggie Stuckey, thank you so much for kicking off our gardening season with this conversation.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. This was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
The Container Victory Garden is out from HarperCollins. April is Poetry Month, but it's also Earth Month on Writer's Voice. We'll be talking with authors about a number of books about the environment and the natural world. Next week, we have Lila Philip talking about her book Beaverland, and Nancy Lawson discusses her book Wildscape. Then later in the month, we talk with Stephen Markley about his acclaimed climate novel, The Deluge. And finally, we wrap up Earth Month talking with the producer-directors of the new film, The Invisible Extinction. They tell us about the threatened ecosystem within us, the microbiome. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.